Now we're going to start for real. Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Joe Tooman, professor of political and legal communication at San Francisco State and also a political commentator for CBS News in San Francisco. We welcome our listeners on the radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce our distinguished speaker, Professor George Lakoff, UC Berkeley professor of linguistics. I don't think that you can really give him a title like that. He is a Renaissance man, a man with a lot of interests. But we know him locally also as the author of The Political Mind, A Cognitive Scientist's Guide to Your Brain and Its Politics, brand new book. Dr. Lakoff has dedicated much of his time to helping progressives better use language to reframe political debates and more clearly get their messages out. During the early years of his professional career, George developed an alternative linguistics theory called generative semantics, which rivaled a theory posited by Noam Chomsky. This led to bitter debates among within the linguistics community in the 1960s that have become known as the linguistics wars. Professor Lakoff's works with conceptual language formation led him to the study of the use of language in politics, specifically the differing use of language by the two major parties in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats, and what that meant to each party's view of the citizen in relation to the state. In addition to his work with politics and language, as I said before, he is a Renaissance man. Dr. Lakoff has taught and done research at several leading institutes of learning, including the University of California at Berkeley, Stanford University, and those other schools on the East Coast, Harvard, I think, you know, and even the University of Michigan, another fine state school. Dr. Lakoff has also been involved with several professional linguistics organizations, including service as president of the International Cognitive Linguistics Association. He writes and contributes to journals on a regular basis and dedicates much of his time to his work, and by the way, I think to the community as well. He'll be talking about some of that tonight. So please join me in welcoming Professor George Lakoff tonight.
Thank you, Joe. I want to start talking for a few minutes at least about what the mind is. And what's been learned in the past 30 years about it, and then go into say why it matters to politics that you understand how your brains work. I grew up with a view of the mind that went like this, and maybe you grew up with a similar view of the mind. It said that reason is conscious, that you know what you think. It said that reason is dispassionate, that passion gets in the way of reason. It said that reason can fit the world directly. You can reason about the world, and that what makes people human beings is reason, and that therefore, since we're all human beings, we all have the same capacity of reason, that what makes us rational is being able to think logically and think critically and logically, and that reason is disembodied, abstract, and that reason developed in order to serve our self-interests, and that since reason can fit the world directly, that words which express concepts are neutral, that they directly refer to things in the world. We've discovered that every one of these is false. Every single one. About 98% of thought is unconscious. You cannot think rationally without emotion. This is a wonderful discovery made by Tony DiMasio, one of our great neuroscientists, written in a book called Descartes' Error. He studied people who had brain injuries and strokes that cut off their ability to feel emotion. When that happens, imagine you can't feel any emotion and you can't tell any emotion anyone else feels. How would you know what to want? Like and like, not like, don't mean anything. You wouldn't know if you did something if people would like you or hate you. How would you know what decisions to make? And these folks don't. You cannot be rational without emotion. Very crucial fact. Second, you cannot just... let me give you a very simple observation. You think with your brain. Now, you may not think that that's a big deal, but it is, because your brain was evolved to run a body, and every bit of information coming into your brain comes through your body, and it's not directly connected to the world. You function in the world, But everything, every single thing you understand must come in through your body to your brain. And the brain is not just a neutral structure. The brain is structured. It's embodied. And moreover, how it's structured, it depends upon what you've experienced. That's an extremely important thing. In the first 5 years of life, half of your neural connections die. The question is, which half? That's why early childhood education is crucial. Once those connections are fixed, that is, neural connections get stronger as the more they're used, you get certain ideas in your head that don't go away ever. Your brain gets structured. And the question is, how is it structured? Is it structured in terms of simple logic? The answer is no. It's structured in terms of things called frames and conceptual metaphors. That is, framing is normal. You can't think anything without a frame. I'll tell you what a frame is in a minute. And every word is defined relative to such a structure. Now, you might think that reason evolved to characterize and deal with self-interest, and certainly that's part of the story. But there's another part that was discovered about 10 years ago, no more, 15 years ago, in Parma, Italy, the discovery of what are called mirror neurons. Turns out that there are parts of the brain that fire when you perform an action or you see someone else perform the same action. Okay, think about that for a minute. Right? Now, those parts of the brain are connected to the emotional regions, which is why if you see someone writhing in pain, you can feel their pain. If you see them happy, you can feel their joy. That's the basis of empathy and of all social interactions, and those neurons fire more when you cooperate. We have a biological basis for empathy and cooperation. Very important, and a lot of our reasoning and our thinking of our metaphor system, our frame system, has to do with social interaction and empathy and connection and cooperation is the basis of that. That is an extremely important thing to know for reasons we will get to. So what we've, and the last part is language is never neutral. Language is defined with respect to frames. So let me tell you a little bit about the history of frames. In the mid-1970s, three major intellectual figures discovered the same phenomenon in different ways. One of them was Charles Fillmore, and I'll talk mainly about him, but also there was a discovery made in sociology. What Fillmore discovered was every word is defined with respect to a frame structure. In sociology, what was discovered was that every institution has a frame structure. What does that mean? Think of a hospital. Okay? A frame structure is a structure of roles that people play. There are doctors, patients, receptionists, orderlies, nurses. There are rooms like operating rooms. There are instruments like scalpels and defibrillators. And there are things you know, scenarios in hospitals. You know that surgeons operate on patients in operating rooms with things like scalpels. Okay. You also know when things don't fit the frame. You walk in to visit a friend in the hospital. You go to the reception desk with your flowers. There's a doctor lying there. They hand you a scalpel saying you're operating on the doctor. Doesn't fit the frame. Right? Now, every word, like operating room or surgeon, is defined with respect to a frame like that. And that's important to know. Every single word. You can't use a word without framing. Framing is normal. You cannot tell the truth without framing. Framing is normal. Now, what happens if you happen to believe the old view of reason, what's called enlightenment reason? If you believe it, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to think that everybody's reasoning according to logic, and that if you just tell people the truth, they'll reason to the right conclusion. For example, Governor Tim Kaine got on Rachel Maddow the other night, and she asked him about what they're going to do about the way that the conservatives are attacking Obama's health care plan. Says, well, we'll just tell the truth. The truth is on our side. We'll tell stories. We've gathered 100,000 of them, right? Wrong. And you see the problems out there, and we'll get to that in a minute. But before I do, I want to talk a little bit about the California budget situation. I have a ballot proposition that I put out there, and it is one sentence long for the 2010 ballot. It's 14 words long. It says, all legislative actions on revenue and budget shall be determined by majority vote. That's it. Anybody want to vote for that? Right? That is what democracy is about. We have minority rule in California. But there's a problem. People think that a two-thirds vote is more democracy. If you have a majority vote, majority people like it. Two-thirds, even better. It's the reverse. Because two-thirds means that one-third plus one controls and can block anything. And that is what has happened. We have minority rule by one-third plus one in either house of our legislature, and that is why we have gridlock, and that is why this state is going to ruin. It is really bad news. And people think that, oh, the people of the state have voted for all this bad stuff. But in fact, it's the reverse. Majority of the voters voted for Democrats in the Assembly and the Senate. The majority of voters voted for responsible people and a responsible budgeting and taxation process. Right? It's minority rule that has led us to ruin, not the voters of this state. But a majority of the voters of this state can pass a one-sentence proposition to change it, to bring democracy back. So now what stands in the way of this? The answer is the Democratic leadership. And that's important. Why? We have good people. There are very good people in the leadership. People like John Burton and Daryl Steinberg, who's going to be here, and Karen Bass and so on. They're against this. Why? Somebody took a poll. Now, if somebody asks you on a poll, do you want your taxes raised? What do you think people will say? Guess what? They asked, would you like taxes on this, taxes on that? And people didn't want taxes. So they said, we can't ask people about to vote on taxes, to get rid of the two-thirds rule on taxes. And then they asked them, do you think it would be better if we had 55% rather than two-thirds? And a lot of people said, yeah. They didn't even ask about the majority. So the leadership is going for 55% and nothing on taxes, 55% on budget. They're following the wrong poll. They thought that the poll was neutral, and it was not. The issue here and the truth has to do with democracy and majority versus minority rule. It's a truth that was hidden by the poll. I'm trying to get money raised for a poll that will ask that question. Do you think that the state should be run by majority or minority rule? What do you think about the idea that if you have a two-thirds vote, one-third plus one can rule the day and cause gridlock? Do you like it or not? Would you vote for one 14-word sentence? Right? We're trying to raise money to get that poll taken to try to get the leadership behind it. But we do have the rank and file. At the Democratic Convention, the Resolutions Committee took that proposition up and passed it unanimously. And the 500 people who decide these things at the Democratic Party, the Executive Committee, overwhelmingly passed the idea of that proposition over the objection of the leadership. So we need a poll, then we need to raise, get it on the ballot, then we need to get 1 million signatures, then we need to pass it with a campaign. That is what is necessary to bring sanity back to this state. One sentence. but one sentence framed to tell the truth. And that's what framing should be about, because we all think that way, but that framing has to activate your thought in order to see it. If you don't have it activated in your brain, you won't see it. Okay? Basic cognitive science. Now, that's why that is important. That's why framing is important. And it's something that a lot of people who are in the democratic leadership, both in the state and at the national level, don't understand. And the reason is they were brought up with Enlightenment reason. They went to college. And if they did any work in public policy, what they did was learn the rational actor model, which is based on Enlightenment reason that doesn't include things like framing at all. It assumes everything is just literal and neutral. But we have a situation where nothing is literal and neutral in this country. The right wing has a communication system that is overwhelming. And you see it now happening with the healthcare plan. The communication system starts with a system of think tanks that get out certain policies. There are language experts, like Frank Luntz put out a directive to conservatives that said, oh, the way to shoot down the healthcare plan is called a government takeover. You know, just say that people are going to have to wait in line, that it's a socialist plot, and so on. You know, all the old ideas, it could have been predicted. And it was predicted. We predicted it at the Rockbridge Institute a couple of years ago, that they would, of course, say that, naturally. But it's not just that they say that. They have a system. The system trains tens of thousands of conservatives down to the age of 15 every year, all over the country in every district. It lists people willing to speak out on certain topics as experts, and then it books them on radio and TV in every city in the country, every day. And then it puts out talking points to those folks every day, and then you hear them on Jon Stewart. Now, the big thing about it is there is no such system that the Democrats have. The best they're trying to do now is get town halls organized. And as you may have heard, one of the main conservative organizations is out there getting people to disrupt town halls, to come and sit, you know, sort of toward the front of the audience with a number of people, 5 or 10 people, and then shout down the speaker with, you know, false information and so on. Right. This is going to happen. I suggest, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with George Miller soon when he comes. I don't know if he'll be disrupted or not. But the fact is, this is happening around the country. And just having the town halls isn't doing the job of getting the messages out every day. In addition, the messaging around the healthcare plan has been inadequate, partly for exactly the reasons we've talked about. Just as Tim Kaine said, we have the truth on our side, and all we have to do is tell people the truth, and they'll reason to the right conclusion. And then they'll give you the policy. Now, one of the main things that was discovered by Ronald Reagan was that people didn't vote on the basis of policy. Very important fact. I learned this from Reagan's chief strategist, Richard Werthlin, who I met some years back, very, very nice gentleman, retired very proud of what he accomplished with Reagan. And I asked him what it was like to be Reagan's chief strategist. And he said, well, you know, I was trained, and he was trained at Berkeley, I was trained to believe that people voted on the basis of candidates' positions on issues. So I did my first poll for Reagan. I discovered that nobody liked Reagan's position on issues, and everybody wanted to vote for Reagan. And he said, I couldn't understand this. It went against everything. I was chief strategist. I had no idea why anyone wanted to vote for my candidate. But he did further surveys, focus groups, and polls, and he discovered why. And the reason was that Reagan talked about values, not just issues and list of policies. When he talked about a policy, it was from the point of view of a value. Reagan was able to connect and communicate with people. Reagan was seen as saying what he believed, as being authentic. And as a result, people trusted Reagan. And if you trust someone, you can identify with them, and people identified with him. So the result was that they ran all of Reagan's campaigns and his administration on those five things. What were they? Values, communication and connection, trust, authenticity, and identity. Okay? Not long lists of issues. Okay? Now, the conservatives understand that very well. And they understand that one more thing. If you repeat language long enough, every time you hear the words, the ideas get stronger. And when the ideas get stronger, they stay in your brain. The synapses get stronger. You'll hear government takeover, government takeover, government takeover, government takeover, and you might believe in government takeover. You know, you'll hear it'll kill old people, it'll kill old people, it'll kill old people. Old people, as one old person was said to say, she was afraid that the government takeover would take away her Medicare. Because it was going to kill old people, right? This is what is happening right now. It's happening all over the country. And, you know, Luntz put out the words, and it's there every day, station after station after station. What are the Democrats not doing? They're not saying what is true and what they know. What they're doing is giving lists, policy lists. We're going to have a public option. It will require competition, blah, 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 right? All true, all correct, right policy. Now, what they're not saying is that what has failed is insurance company health care. That is the problem. They're not saying, have you ever had to wait for an authorization for weeks? Any of you ever had to wait for an authorization? Anybody here ever been denied for an authorization? Anybody ever have to wait to see a specialist? Anybody know anybody who lost their health care? Everybody knows that in America. They don't say it. They don't say it because there is a real villain out there, and they're not naming the villain. It's crucial. The government's health care, and they give it a terrible name, public option. And what that does is allow the other guys to say, it's the government. It's a very simple thing. This is a plan for the American people. It should be called the American plan. You know, are you for the American plan or not? It's straightforward. You know, and I've written about it at length and so on, and as have others. But if you were raised with Enlightenment reason and you're following the people who are public policy experts, then they're going to give you the long list of policies and assume that this is about your self-interest. Remember, that's what this is about. They're going to try to appeal to your self-interest. If you lose your job, you're not going to get, your health care will be, you know, continued. There won't be pre-existing conditions. They're not going to be this. You know, we're going to save money on administration. What they're not telling you is you got insurance company health care that is hiring people paying about 20 to 30% often of your premiums to deny you care. Their job, the reason that you have to wait for authorizations is they're looking for ways to deny you care. And they get profit every time you pay your premium and they can deny you care. Right? Or if they can delay care, they win. They make more profit if they can delay your care. Right? That is what is going on. Nobody is saying it. That's the truth. And you know it. And everybody in the country who's experienced it knows it. They're not allowing the people of America to focus on and have activated in their brains the truth that they've experienced. And the reason is they believe in enlightenment reason. They think if you just tell people the policies and you list them, they'll win. They won't. They can't fight government takeover, they'll kill your old people, et cetera, et cetera. They can't fight that repetition. And they do not have a system of communication in place. They have to depend upon town meetings. They don't have tens of thousands of people out there speaking at every possible public event every day, booked on radio and TV every day. And the Democrats have known about the Republican system for over a decade and have done nothing about it. They've said, oh, well, we can't be like the conservatives. They play dirty. Well, most of the conservatives say what they believe. They actually believe what they say. Some of them are lying. Okay, yes, we know we can count the lies, but that's most of the spokesmen out there are out there. They're people who believe in what they say. We have progressives who believe in what they say, but they're not getting through because there's no system for them to get through. So this is very important. It is not the case that the leaders lead. It is not the case that the leaders lead. You lead. Everyone who is in public office needs cover. The very first thing. They need a marching band to get out in front of. They can't come out and say something that nobody has heard before because it'll sound silly. It won't make any sense. We, the public, have to get out there and organize. And in California, that organization is starting on the issue of majority versus minority rule. I spoke to 100 Democratic leaders last night. They're organizing a speaker's bureau. They're organizing training sessions. They're recruiting people who want to go out and speak about majority versus minority rule and all the horrible things that minority rule has done for this state, and they want to get them in every district, especially Republican districts. Why? Because it only takes about 4 more Republican votes to pass reasonable legislation. Right? That's very crucial. This is a tough time for our state, and it's not because the people of the state voted for what is going on here. It's because a minority is in control of it because of certain propositions in the past that have passed and structured the way we do our budget and the way we do our taxes. And that can be changed by one sentence. Thank you.
Okay. How are we doing on time, by the way? Okay. Well, at this point, we're going to go to some questions. Before we do, though, let me just remind people that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're speaking tonight with Professor George Lakoff, whose new book, The Political Mind, A Cognitive Scientist's Guide to Your Brain and Its Politics, is available and highly recommended, by the way. George, we have a number of questions from the group, but I'm going to start with a couple from me, exercising my prerogative as a moderator, so that maybe we can, if not level the playing field for everybody, because there are some questions that ask about terminology, make sure that everybody here, in the spirit of your presentation, is speaking the same language. So here's a question. Tonight, and I remember reading this in your book, and I was thinking about that too, we've mixed terms like conservatives, Republicans, as you've noted in previous presentations, liberals that became progressives after liberal became a bad word. Now you use neoliberal. Then we have Democrats. Are these all the same thing, or how are they different, and what do you mean when you talk about conservatives, but sometimes you say Republican?
Okay. There are two worldviews that I identified in a book called Moral Politics that answer the following question. I worried about this back in the mid-90s. I didn't understand at that time why it was that the same people who were against abortion were for the flat tax. and why the people for the flat tax were against environmental regulations, and why those people were in favor of owning machine guns, and why those people who are in favor of owning guns were for tort reform. It didn't make any sense at all. Then I asked myself, well, I was against all these, what sense did it make to me? And it couldn't answer the question. But I realized it was in my field of cognitive science and linguistics. That's what I study. I study how the mind creates meaning. And what I found out after a while, when I started asking why conservatives were talking about family values and what those values were, was that we have a metaphor that the nation is a family. It's actually more general than that, that any governing institution is a family because your first experience with governance is in your family. So it could be, you know, religions or little league teams or classrooms or the nation. And we have in this country two kinds of families that are really different and really significant, a strict father family and a nurturing parent family, and they're very, very different. The strict father family is what James Dobson has been pushing for some times at Focus on the Family. And it says that you need a strict father to protect the family. Mommy can't do it. This has got to be a, you know, not a homosexual family. Right? Impossible. No gay families there. You need a strict father to support the family. Mommy can't do it. And kids are born bad in the sense that they just want to do what feels good. You ever hear of feel-good liberalism? Right? That's what they mean. They, you know, the kids just do it what feels good rather than they don't know right from wrong. They have to be taught right from wrong. There's only one way to do it, punishment when they do wrong. And as Dobson says, it must be painful enough so that they will avoid doing wrong and get disciplined to do right. And he's very clear about the pain involved. It must be physical pain. It must hurt. However, he's a liberal on this. He says you should never strike a child younger than 15 months. other conservatives start with birth. Seriously, read the texts. And in Moral Politics, there's a chapter going through all those texts. Then he says if you get that discipline, you can go out into the free market and use that discipline to become get fiscal discipline and become prosperous. So what if you're not prosperous? You're not disciplined. If you're not disciplined, you're not moral, so you deserve your poverty. Right? And what about the father in the family? The father is the decider. Ever hear that, Pat? All right, how does that apply to the market? Ever hear let the market decide? In the family, there's nobody, no moral authority above the father. The father knows right from wrong, and everybody's supposed to follow what they say. And similarly for the market. There's not supposed to be government anything above the market for conservatives. So what are the things above the market? Four things: regulation, taxation, unionization, or worker rights, and tort cases. That's what they want to get rid of. Right? In a nurturing parent family, you have something very different. It starts with empathy. You have to empathize with your child. You have to be responsible for yourself and your child, and you have to teach your child to be empathized and be responsible toward others, to nurture others. And you have to have an ethic of excellence. You have to become a better person to raise a child, and you have to learn, have your child become the best person possible in order to function in a society. If you've heard those words before, they came from Barack Obama. The place that's clearest is his Father's Day speech in 2008. But he has said it over and over. And one of the things that is very interesting about Obama is Obama argues that the basis of democracy is empathy. And the argument's very simple. Why do we have fairness and freedom for everybody, not just powerful people? The answer is because citizens care about each other. As citizens, that's our job, to take care of one another. And that's the job of government. And he says that directly. And what does that mean for government? Two things. Government has two moral missions, protection and empowerment. Protection is not just police and military protection, but worker protection, consumer protection, environmental protection, health care, pension protection, and so on. And what is empowerment? Everything that was in Obama's stimulus plan. Very simple. That's it. You have public works, public roads, schools, education, all of those things that are out there that were in the stimulus plan. That is it. So that is important to understand. And what do you pay taxes for? To live in a place that's not a third world country, but has protection and empowerment.
Okay. Very good. Let's go to some of the questions from our audience tonight, and I'll start with a couple of specific questions about conservative framing. So one of those comes from one of our audience members tonight. So many conservatives pursue or support policies contrary to their best interests. In addition to framing itself, is there some sort of psychological framework, I don't quite get the other word, about these extreme views, and could you comment on that?
Well, there's a very interesting phenomenon that was constructed. By the way, I want to say one more thing. The brain is such that most of us have both of these worldviews, and there are a lot of people who are conservative about one thing and liberal on another, and there's a phenomenon called mutual inhibition in the brain where one circuit can inhibit the other or conversely depending on context. So that happens a lot, and there's no such thing as a moderate. There are just lots of people who have come, you know, who are conservative or liberal in all kinds of different directions. Now, why is it that so many poor conservatives vote against their interests? Because they're not voting on their interests, they're voting on their identity. How is that identity constructed? It was constructed consciously beginning around 1966 in the Nixon campaign by people like Roger Ailes, then working for Nixon. What they realized was that at the height of the Vietnam War and the women's movement, there were a lot of poor people who previously identified as liberals, as working people, but who had strict father views about the family and about the military. And so they were threatened by radical feminism and they were threatened by war protests, and they didn't like them. So Nixon and company talked about patriotism, anti-communism, horrible war protesters, bra burners, etc., to recruit those folks. They did something else because these are folks who, because of their unionization, were liberals and saw liberals as heroes. So they invented a new concept called the liberal elite. That is, the liberal elite is the latte liberals. I'm sorry, I didn't get the chance to get my latte before coming over. The latte liberals, the Hollywood liberals, the tax and spend liberals, et cetera, that sushi-eating, Birkenstock-wearing, et cetera, liberals. Now, and the idea was that the liberals looked down on ordinary working people. Right? They've been repeating this for 40 years. You know, that's happened over and over. And Sarah Palin is very expert at delivering messages about that. You know, and it's out there. They constructed a whole population of people who believe in the liberal elite, that liberals are looking down on them, and that they're conservatives. And this is not about self-interest. It's about identity. Because these guys understood, you know, what Ronald Reagan learned.
Okay, since you mentioned Sarah Palin, here's another question about her. What does Sarah Palin's farewell talk indicate about the state of political discourse in the U.S.?
Well, I would expect that Sarah Palin should have a show on Fox before very long.
I think so, too.
I think it's prep for that, and it makes sense. First of all, they would pay for her wardrobe. No problem. I mean, that's what they pay for. And secondly, they would have experts tutoring her every day. And after 3.5 years, she might actually remember some of it. But you know, she's not dumb. She's just ignorant, but very clever. She deeply understands what conservatism is about. She really knows those values intimately. And that's why the intellectual leaders of the conservative movement, people like William Kristol, are big Palin supporters.
Let me ask a follow-up, though. Where does Sarah Palin, if we inject gender into this, fit into the strong father model that you were talking about before?
Well, this is an interesting case. She's been the ideal wife of the strict father who supports him. She was out there, supporting the McCain in that election. Unfortunately, she also went out and became a bit independent, which went against being the ideal conservative wife. But it's interesting. She is going to have to craft something in which she is the modern conservative woman. Hmm. And, so the idea was she was the good mother, she's got lots of kids, and she's strong. She has all the conservative values. You know, she can shoot a moose and cook it up for dinner.
Not bacon, right. Okay. Okay, another follow-up question from one of the audience members. Still on the subject of conservatives, this is a funny question. What aspect of language do you hope conservatives never figure out?
I think truth-telling with appropriate framing. That is, if they really ask themselves what is going on truthfully in these situations, and what framing makes sense of that truth, then the question is, would they still be conservatives? Or rather, would they then say, we can find some conservative reason to fit this in some way? And that would be an interesting issue, because that's what a lot of people do. They pick and choose their facts, and then they say, these are the facts that matter, that reinforce my beliefs. I think they're so good at it that I don't have to, worry about them finding some other thing. I mean, they've already got most of it.
Okay. Here's another question that I think is in the same spirit. One of the audience members, these are the quotes, mentioned that you talked about a Republican propaganda machine, but you didn't mention that there was any left-wing propaganda machine. And his or her question was, what about the existing news media? He says media, or she says media, but I think they meant news media. What is the Republican system you're talking about, and how do you juxtapose that with the existing news media, which people think is liberal?
Well, it's not. I mean, what was shown was there is no such thing as a liberal media. It's mainly owned by right-wing folks. But what's interesting about it is the people will say, but so many people who are reporters happen to be liberals. Now, what's particularly interesting to me is this. I teach at Berkeley, and every now and then I'm invited by the journalism school to come and teach their first-year graduate. Not the whole course, but come and give a lecture to the first-year graduate students. And I talk to them like I talk to you, and inevitably, within about 20 minutes, somebody raises his hand and says, that's the opposite of what we're being taught. We're being taught everything is rational, that we should just use the most popular words out there because people will understand them. And we're supposed to say who, what, when, where, and that's it, right? Well, what does that mean? It means they're being taught to accept the words put out there by conservatives, by the conservative message machine, because those are the ones that have become most popular. And you see this in the New York Times. I'm reading the New York Times, and there is tax relief on the front page. You know, when tax relief is a conservative idea, it says that taxation is an affliction, and you need relief from it, and anybody who's against relief wants to continue this affliction, right? It's not about taxation is what empowers you to be able to make a living. Yeah? They don't say that on the front page of the New York Times. And this is crucial. When you're reading liberal reporting by people you know are liberals, they wind up doing conservative reporting because they're simply repeating the conservative language. So what happens is that you get this effect that One, the conservatives own the media, and of course, in some cases, as we've seen with CBS and other news media,
careful.
Well, I don't mean the local station, but the national station. On the national station, you've heard that the people owning CBS have said you can't talk about certain things. And that's from a conservative perspective. Another thing, a way that this works, is on CNN. You get somebody like Wolf Blitzer who asks all the conservative-framed questions. And there was a great moment during last year's Democratic nomination debates where they had, all the nine people up there running, and Wolf Blitzer says, "Raise your hands. Do you think that English should be the national language of the United States? Raise your hands." Silence. Everybody looks shocked. Barack Obama stands up and walks directly at Wolf Blitzer. He takes three steps and says, "That is the question formulated to divide us. Here is the real issue," and then talk sensibly about it. A great moment. I cheered.
Okay, in that spirit, let me take us away from framing just for a moment back into some of the issues that you talked about where we could apply framing. You mentioned healthcare tonight, and I thought your points were very interesting. Democrats, I think you would agree to this point, have not articulated a moral frame to rationalize their case for healthcare, right? So two quick questions. First, is that because they don't have a reconciled piece of legislation yet, so they don't know what the frame is? And if so, does that mean that you shouldn't frame something until you know what you're framing? And secondly, what would be the moral frame for them, as far as you're concerned, if you were going to advise them to advocate health care?
It's very simple. Health care is a matter of life and death. What's more moral than that? And this is a case where health care has failed because of insurance companies trying to deny people care for the profit motive. And the reason it's so expensive is that at least a third of it is spent on administrative costs trying to deny you care, plus profits into investors, right? If you take that third, you can use it to cover everybody. And not only that, there's a lot of waste in this system, and that can be eliminated in all kinds of ways because insurance company health care is inefficient. If you think about it, Medicare has 3% administrative costs. It's efficient. The inefficiency is in the private healthcare system. They're inefficient. They don't have a computerized system. They don't know what's going on with your records. Anybody ever have the problem of going in to see a doctor and the doctor didn't have all your records? Right? Happens all the time. Right? You have an inefficient healthcare system, one that's run for profit. And that is there to deny you care. That's immoral because health is a matter of life and death.
And what about the first question? Have they not done this in your judgment because they don't have a piece of legislation yet?
Or no,
because they haven't
all.
Bought into what you've been talking about?
No, they have. Look, the general outline of the legislation has been the same from the beginning. You want to have a public option. There are certain constraints on it. One, you want to make the healthcare people compete with the public plan. Okay? First. Second, you want to get rid of preconditions. You want to be able to change your jobs and not lose your healthcare. Right? Simple. Those are the constraints. If you get those and you want to cover all the people not covered or almost all the people not covered. Right, and you want to be sure that there's no cherry picking. That means that, and that people who are young are going to pay into the system because they're going to pay for people who are older, and then when they get old, people will be paying for them. That's how insurance works. That's what insurance is. Okay, now this is crucial, and they need and they've been saying those things, but it's practical, not moral. It's this pragmatic detail of policy. Not, this is a matter of life and death. Have you ever been denied authorization? Do you have to wait for it? Do you have to wait to see a specialist when you got hurt and you're hurting? You know, or you really need care now. Have you ever been denied care? Do you know people who have been denied care? We can't allow that. I mean, this is a moral issue. It's a matter of life and death. Right? They're not saying that. And there are villains out there. They are companies that are doing things that are immoral, and they're inefficient. Right? The efficient health care is Medicare. That's not being said.
Okay. Okay, on to a different question. This about actually the business of consulting and campaigns. What percentage of Democrat and Republican strategists and media consultants share your views? Does everyone else have what you referred to as an Enlightenment perspective?
Well, this is a mixed bag. There are some media consultants who understand this very well. On the right wing, you have Luntz, who understands it very well and is very effective. Among the Democratic consultants, you have Drew Weston, who wrote The Political Brain, who understands it very well. He's a very sharp guy, and he's a neuroscientist and a good one. There are all sorts of people. And the Obama administration and the Obama campaign had plenty of people who understood this. They were very, very good in the campaign. But running an administration is different from running a campaign. They don't have a communication system now. Just letting Obama say it isn't enough. And what they're doing is depending on polls. So let me tell you a bit about healthcare polls. All right. If you ask a pollster what's going on, you'll get the following answer. What percentage of voters have health care? Answer, 94% of voters. What percent of people? Maybe 70%, but 94% of voters. If you ask them the following question, are you satisfied with your health care? How many people say yes? 77%. They do not ask the question, have you ever been denied authorization? Have you had to wait for authorization? Have you had to wait to see specialists? They don't ask those questions. Do you know anybody who's lost their health care? Do you know anybody who's afraid of losing their jobs because they might lose their health care? They haven't asked those questions on those polls. So the answers to the polls have been determining what people have been willing to say. They've also been determining what's going on in Congress. And they've been determining a lot about what the people who are making up the details of the health plans are willing to do. That is, they're under pressure, both from the healthcare industry and from people in various districts who are taking their own polls. Right? They're not asking the right poll questions. Right? This is important. I think the Obama administration came in with a very reasonable idea, and they thought that if you just tell people the truth, they'll reason to the right conclusion, just as Tim Kaine said.
A follow-up then on this. There was one of our listeners had asked what aspect of framing did President Obama employ most effectively. I think they meant probably during the campaign. Let me add a piggyback to that. Was Obama's narrative his own frame, which is to say, is he his own frame? And is that the reason he's not effective right now at governing?
There's a lot of truth to that. Think about the following. How do you feel when you see Obama? Do you feel tense? No. You feel relaxed. You know, what about McCain? Yeah. All right? Do you have a sense that Obama cares? You see empathy all over him, right? His body language reflects calmness. It reflects coolness. It reflects empathy. That's what he's about. There was no question about that. And I think there still is no question about it. Where he goes wrong is this. When he goes into press conferences, he tries to be a policy wonk. And he goes through the policies, the policies, the policies. And then he tells the stories, and the stories are about empathy. And the stories are about caring. And the stories are about responsibility and about villains. But he never says the words that evoke it. You know, and that, I think, is sad. He's not taking on the enemies. And there are enemies out there, as they said, they're trying to take him down. And then he makes fun. He says, well, this isn't about me. It's about the American people, blah, blah, blah. It's not just about him. It is about him and the American people because we depend on him.
Let me dig in there for just a moment, though. The two words that framed his candidacy were hope and change.
No.
Right? No?
No.
Well, that was the word. Those were the words he used.
Those are the words and used. But, all right, I got an interesting question from CBS News during the campaign about that. Somebody who's a very smart reporter called up and said, what's this stuff about hope and change and yes, we can? That doesn't mean anything. Hope for what? Change for what? Anybody could use that. You know, and the answer to that is, did you ever listen to the previous four sentences? Because those were the things that gave you the values of empathy and responsibility and social responsibility and making the world better, right? That was what the change was about, what the hope was about. The hope and change referred back to other things.
Mostly in his own personal narrative, right?
In his personal narrative, they were there in the personal narrative, but they were there in stories about the country as well because they blended. You know, the story about his mother having cancer was about healthcare, right? So, yes, they were in his personal narrative. In governing, it's a lot harder because you've got to deal with the blue dogs. You know, you've got to deal with all kinds of people who in their districts have the conservative message machine telling the people who vote for them just all the conservative messages over and over and over.
So I promise I'll come right back to these, but we have a thread here and I want to yank on a little bit. You talked before about Ronald Reagan's effectiveness at articulating a moral center for framing his positions before and the five principles, for example, that his advisors did. Barack Obama has oftentimes been compared to President Kennedy. But maybe there's also a comparison to Ronald Reagan. What should Obama do differently in governing that maybe models what Reagan did?
I think he needs to be less of a policy wonk. You know, yes, it turns out he is one of the smartest people around. He understands every little detail of policy completely. If he's at a press conference, he can impress all the people in the press that he knows all the details. But that's different from convincing the public of the moral stance behind it. You have to make a moral statement. You have to say who the heroes are and who the villains are. You have to say what the moral narrative of each case is and what the moral case for it is. And then, if you're authentic and you connect, people will trust you and follow you. But, you know, what he's doing now, I think, is, you know, he's very, very smart. Incredibly smart. And he's showing that, which gives you some confidence, but at the same time, he needs to actually take on the villains and be a hero.
For our radio audience, by the way, once again, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. We're joined today by Professor George Lakoff, and we're talking about the language of politics and the politics of language. Okay. George, let me take us back in a different direction real quickly, issue-wise. You mentioned your ballot initiative, and we had one of our audience members ask this question, do other states in the United States have a two-thirds majority rule policy, to your knowledge?
Very few. Nobody has them both on budget and taxes. There are a few states that have them on taxes, and they don't work very well. They don't work very well there at all. But mostly, no. This is California weirdness.
A practical question. Let me just play devil's advocate with you for a moment. If your initiative passed, then the party in control would have very little reason to talk to the party that was a minority party on big questions, right?
No, I don't think so at all. Because in many cases, you really need lots of support in lots of districts to get things passed. There are a lot of things that affect people all around the state. There are a lot of very complex issues, and of course you would have to get them. And some of the members of the majority might not vote with you, as you're seeing in Congress right now. So you're going to have to be able to do that anyway. So I don't see that.
Okay. Back to political frames. This one on the war on terror. Question from the audience. Would you say that political frames intended to manipulate people, such as the war on terror, this is an interesting question, are more transparent to those for whom English is a second language?
One of the interesting things about coming to a new language is you notice what other people don't notice. And I think that there's something, some truth to that. That if you hear war and terror, war and terror, war and terror, and it just becomes normal, someone from another country will say, what is that? It's a double metaphor. It's weird. Why aren't people saying how weird that is? You know, there's terrorists. What do you mean war? Well, war is there, mainly to give power to the president and give him war powers. That's what happened with Bush. Bush, declared war on terror and, got war powers. And that is very important. He then became the decider, not just in military matters, but in all matters. And that is what is crucial in war on terror. It's a terrible word. I'm sorry, but I think it's an awful phrase, and it's one that Obama has said don't use ever, and it should be forever banned, because the issue of terrorism may be real and it is real, but it's very different from war. You don't fight terrorism by mobilizing, airplanes and aircraft carriers and so on. Every now and then there's a camp you might want to wipe out. But mostly it's at the level of individual people and people who are recruited to be terrorists. And the way you deal with it very often is the way you deal with international police work, as they do in England.
Let's stay on the question of democratic leadership then, since we're talking about President Obama. We've talked about Obama really as the head of the Democratic Party, but he has partners in the Congress. And we've also talked a little bit about gender tonight, so now I'm going to throw you a curveball. If you were giving advice to Speaker Pelosi, who also has a defined persona and her negatives are larger than her positives right now in terms of public approval ratings, and she has a job of selling the congressional version of this, what would you tell her, and would it be the same as what you mentioned about President Obama in terms of framing health care?
I would say a lot of the same things, but I want to say one thing. I think Nancy Pelosi is great because I know what she's facing. She's facing a Democratic Party divided in three with lots of interests out there, every day basically trying to bribe people through campaign contributions. And also, she's facing the fact that people in red districts, all the blue dogs, are out there facing their constituents when their constituents hear conservative broadcasts day after day after day after day. And she has to deal with that. And I think she has dealt with it as well as anybody reasonably could under the circumstances. Now, given that, I think that one of the things she should do is learn a bit more about how to frame these messages well. She has gone along with the idea that if you just tell people the right policy, they'll reason to the right conclusions. And it's not true. But I think she needs to be better at that. But at her job, I think she's absolutely remarkable. And she doesn't need the public approval in the United States. She needs to be effective in Congress, and she needs to, be reelected here, which she will be. But I have nothing but admiration for Nancy Pelosi. I do wish that, she would frame some things better, but I have to say she's got a really tough job, and she's doing it very well.
That was a very diplomatic answer. And an honest one, I'm sure, too.
No, I admire her.
Okay. How much time do we have left? We in our last minute. But George, I'll ask you one last question, and then we'll take our break. This is a question on social networks from Emily in the audience. And her question is, would you say that the popularity, this will be our last question, of online social networks such as Facebook, and I guess we'll throw in Twitter as well, have changed the way that people construct self-identity and narrative in terms of political affiliation?
It hasn't really done it yet. It may. It has all kinds of possibilities for organizing. And the Democrats trying to overturn the two-thirds rule are trying to use Facebook right now. We'll find out how well it's there. It's a tool. And the question is, are we going to learn how to use it well? The conservatives are using the same tool, and they're using it well.
Okay. I hope you'll join me in thanking George Lakoff, UC Berkeley Professor of Linguistics and author of The Political Mind, A Cognitive Scientist's Guide to Your Brain and Its Politics. We also thank our live audience here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. And for now, I'm Joe Tooman, and this is the Lafayette meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion. And we are adjourned. Thank you for being here.